You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 7 of a series in Ezra and Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, "Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you, day and night, for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations, but if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favour in the presence of this man.' I was cupbearer to the king." It's interesting to compare the introduction of this book with Ezra's introduction of himself within his book, where we had a very lengthy genealogy of Ezra going right back to Aaron the priest, but Nehemiah simply introduces himself as Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, or rather the book is introduced with that heading that says these are his words. Nehemiah dates his discovery in verse 1. It says the month of Kislev in the 20th year. And this refers to the 20th year of the reign of King Artaxerxes, and that puts it in 445 BC or thereabouts. So we've moved forward from the time of Ezra by about 13 years, and Nehemiah is still in Persia, as some of the Jewish people were. Not all had returned to Jerusalem, but he's there in the citadel of Susa. And Hanani, when it says one of his brothers, doesn't necessarily mean a biological brother, or at least a close relative. It could be a part of his extended family, or perhaps even just his brother Jew, his fellow Jewish man. They came from Judah. There was obviously travel back and forward between the capital of the empire and Jerusalem. And Nehemiah asks about the remnant and what's happening to them. And the news that he gets is not positive. It says that they're in trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. Now, we don't know whether this is referring to damage that had been done in the time of Nebuchadnezzar that had never been repaired. Certainly, we read in the book of Ezra about the city being rebuilt, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the walls were rebuilt. Or whether this is some damage that had happened, at least the burning of the gates subsequently. But in any case, we do read about Nehemiah's reaction. And Nehemiah, I think one of the great lessons that we learn from this man and from this book is that he responds in prayer. Nehemiah is a great example of a man of prayer. And he sits down and weeps, and he mourns for several days, fasting and praying. This is not something that is just a minor thing. You know, sometimes you can be deeply moved by something, but it doesn't move you to a commitment like Nehemiah's, a commitment to actually seek God and create space and engage in fasting that allows you to create that space to ask God what it is that he might want you to do in response. Nehemiah is determined to know what God's will or God's heart is in this whole issue. How is he to respond? What would be faithful? What does God expect or require of him? And so he takes the time. I think we need to do that more often at times. So certainly in my own experience, I can get worried or distressed or frustrated about situations. And I don't often take enough time just to simply ask God for his perspective. I do pray. I do ask him. But sometimes there's no substitute for actually a sustained period of seeking God. It's not because somehow that's going to persuade God that we're serious about it, but it is because we are slow to listen, slow to hear, slow to learn. And so Nehemiah does the right thing in this situation. He's mourning because he's deeply affected by this. That might seem a little bit odd because he's, of course, still in Susa. And in fact, we know that he's the royal cupbearer. We don't know that until the end of the chapter. So why should this affect him so deeply? But Nehemiah loves God, and Nehemiah loves the people of God, and he loves the city of Jerusalem. And so as he prays, we have this account of his prayer, and it really is a great prayer, an example of prayer, I think. Like many of the prayers in Scripture, we could learn a great deal from it. He speaks to the Lord, Yahweh, the heaven, God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Just that one verse is a wonderful statement of the character of the God of Israel. He is Yahweh, that's his covenant name. He is the I Am, that name that derives from that statement that God gives to Moses, where he says, I am who I am, back in Exodus chapter 4. He is, I think it's chapter 4, possibly chapter 3, but he is Yahweh. He is the God of heaven. That's a phrase that is used in Ezra as well, and perhaps seems to have been particularly used by the Jews when they were in exile. I think it's emphasizing the heavenly nature of God's rule. That even though there was no land where people were worshipping God as the national God, that God remained the God of heaven. Elsewhere in the Old Testament, he's the God of heaven and earth, and it's emphasizing his sovereignty over all other gods or all other spiritual beings who might claim to be God or all other things that people set up as gods. He's the God of heaven, the great and awesome God. This is the transcendent God. God who is great and awesome. But he's not just the transcendent God, he is also the immanent God, the God who is close to his people, who cares about his people, because the sentence continues and says he keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments. This is a wonderful statement about who God is. God is transcendent, glorious, awesome, majestic, powerful, great, the God of heaven. But he's also the God of love and of covenant, who binds himself to people through promises that he cannot and will not break. It's really quite a remarkable thing. No other religion on earth has that understanding of the character of God other than Judaism and Christianity, which of course developed out of the Old Testament religion, modern Judaism. Not the same as the Old Testament religion, but developed from it, and Christianity, which is the other development of Old Testament religion, the fulfillment of it through the person of Jesus, Israel's Messiah. Islam is monotheistic, but has a developed sense of the transcendence of God, but very limited sense of the immanence of God. Yes, there are Muslim people who talk about an experiential dimension of their faith, who engage in practices of Sufism or Islamic mysticism, but they are not, but Muslim doctrine and the Quran doesn't really have that sense of the immanence of God. And certainly the idea of God as a covenant-making God is foreign to Islam. That would be to lessen God to lessen his power and his sovereignty if he was to bind himself to people. You can't presume upon God's commitment to you or God's love. God is utterly sovereign and therefore above being bound to people in covenant. Of course, other religions of the world have impersonal concepts of God, gods who are not transcendent, who are simply at one with nature or in all aspects of nature. And the religions of the East, of India and of China tend in that direction. But this is the true God, the creator God, the God of heaven, who rules over all. He is both transcendent and immanent in covenant. And as Nehemiah prays to him, he says, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open. Of course, anthropomorphic language is often used of God. It's not that God has ears or eyes, but it's a human way of thinking about God in physical terms. And until the coming of Jesus, that is, God didn't have any physical form, but when he was incarnate on earth, of course, God took human form. But he asks for God to listen and to see the prayer of his servant. And Nehemiah's prayer is a selfless prayer. It's a prayer for the nation of Israel. It's a prayer that I suppose if we were praying along these lines, we'd be praying for the church. I wonder what you see when you look at the church in the town where you live, or in the country where you live, or in the county or area where you live. What do you see? Do you see a church that is healthy? A church that is blossoming, that is bearing fruit for Christ? I'm sure it is in many ways, because wherever God's people are, there will be fruit that is born to the glory of God. Give thanks for that. But perhaps you also see weaknesses and deficiencies. Well, do those weaknesses grieve you? And if they do you just complain about it? Do you just moan about it, or do you cry out to God? And notice what Nehemiah is doing. He's saying, look, I am your servant. I'm praying for your servants. In other words, Nehemiah understands himself to be part of the issue, not distant from it. He could say back in Susa, well, that's not my problem. I'm not the one who's been given that task. It's not my job. And that's like me looking at a church that I'm not part of and finding fault with it and criticizing it. But actually, I am part of it. There is only one people of God. There was only one Israel, whether they were in Susa or in Jerusalem. There is only one church. And so Nehemiah knows that he's part of the issue. He's also part of the problem. That's the attitude we ought to have when we see weaknesses or deficiencies in the church. You know, we can't just say, well, that's not me, that's them. Or that's not my part of the church, that's theirs. Or I'm not responsible for this whenever there's a weakness or a problem in my church, in my congregation. No, I am one of God's servants, and my question ought to be to God, well, how do I help to do my bit to rectify the problem that I see? So I'm challenging you, and I'm challenging my own heart. When we see faults, the question ought to be, what are we going to do about it? Well, what Nehemiah does is to confess the sins of Israel, including himself and his father's family. Again, he's locating himself within it. You know, there are sins in cultures, even within churches, that are passed down through generations of attitudes that go back long, long ways, and it's important to acknowledge those. Nehemiah doesn't mince his words about this. He doesn't try and make excuses. He says, we've acted very wickedly. We haven't kept the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Notice the contrast in verse 5. It's God who keeps his covenant, but we have not kept it. Nehemiah knows the reason for the exile. He knows the reason why Israel is so weak, because they were unfaithful to God. But he also knows what God said through Moses. You can read about it in Deuteronomy chapter 4, and Nehemiah is familiar with that passage, with how God had warned them even at the time when he gave the law that if they were unfaithful, they would be scattered, they would be exiled. But if they returned to him and obeyed him, then wherever they were in the world, God would bring them back. You see, the exile should not have been a surprise to Israel. It was exactly what God had warned them about, that this covenant required a faithfulness on their part. Not that God would abandon the covenant, because even back there in Deuteronomy, he was saying he would keep people faithful, a faithful remnant, if you like, during the exile, who he would bring back when they turned to him. So it's not that God abandoned the covenant, but that God was purifying his people, bringing them back to himself through the process of the exile, through the judgment that he brought on them through the nations of Assyria and of Babylon, and now of the Persians, who had taken over from Babylon as the major power. Here is prayer that is grounded in the character of God, in verse 5, and in the promises of God, here in verses 8 and 9, and in a commitment to, in a confession of sin, first of all, and a commitment to be the servant of God. This is the model of true prayer. It is prayer that seeks God's kingdom, that acknowledges who he is. It is prayer that seeks God's will, that is ready to obey what he commands. It's prayer that confesses sin, and it's prayer that trusts in God's promise. True prayer is always according to the will of God, and one of the ways that our prayers are shaped according to his will is by knowing what God has actually promised. Very important to know what God has promised and what he hasn't. Israel, God, or Nehemiah reminds the Lord, are his servants and his people who were redeemed by him. Again, Nehemiah knows his salvation history. That redemption, of course, goes right back to the time of Moses and the Exodus, redeemed out of Egypt with his great strength and mighty hand. And so Nehemiah asks that God would be attentive to his prayer and to the prayers of the other faithful Israelites who delight in revering God's name. Nehemiah's concern is for the glory of God, but he knows that the glory of God is tied up with the fate of the nation of Israel. It is through Israel that God makes his glory known, that God shows his wisdom to the world, that God reveals his truth to the world. And the story of Israel has not finished with the exile, and the state of affairs in Jerusalem is not good enough. That small community of exiles of a few thousand, or a few tens of thousands, are at risk of returned exiles in Jerusalem. They're at real risk. They have no walls to protect them from any attack. They could be wiped out at any moment, and it's not acceptable for Nehemiah. And so he asks for success. Again, prayer should be bold before God, but only whenever it's prayer that is concerned for the glory of God. It's still through his people that God reveals his glory. It's still through his faithfulness to his covenant promises that God makes himself known to the nations. God is working out his purpose in the church, and so we ought to be committed to the health of the church. We ought to be committed to that in terms of revering God's name. And when we're asking for that, then it's right for us to ask for success in that task. But Nehemiah has a plan. We'll see what that plan is in chapter 2 in the next episode. But that plan is going to require him to have favour in the presence of a certain man as his prayer comes to an end. That's intriguing. Who is the man? Because notice Nehemiah hasn't told us, I've already mentioned it earlier, what his position was. But he hasn't told us yet at this point. He hasn't recorded it for us. For all we know, Nehemiah might just be an ordinary person with no particular status or privilege or opportunity. But Nehemiah has a very particular position which gives him access to no less than the Persian king. But he prays that God will give him favour in the presence of the king. Again, this is a consistent pattern of prayer. You saw it in Ezra as well, that perspective that comes through in the book of Ezra that says that God moved the hearts of kings. And this idea that God gives favour to people in the eyes of others. You see it at other points in the Old Testament, the sovereign movement of God to move the hearts of even those who are resistant to him. Nehemiah asks for favour in the presence of a man. And then just like a little explanatory note, I was cupbearer to the king. I love the way Nehemiah works this passage or writes this passage. I love the fact that it gives the attention to God and to God's purposes. Nehemiah doesn't begin by trotting out his credentials, by telling us who he is, by establishing that he is a somebody. It's not because of Nehemiah's position that he's confident that he can do something for God. In fact, he's not confident. He's asking for favour. He knows that if he asks the king for something, just like Esther knew, if you read the book of Esther, that there's a real risk that the king might be angered and might execute him or cast him out from his position. He knows that. But what he is certain of is that he cannot live his life in comfort while Jerusalem's walls are broken down. He must stand up and be counted. He must give his life to something greater, and it's the glory of God that concerns him, and so he's willing to take the risk. I find that very challenging and inspiring. I wonder what risks I'm prepared to take from the position that I have in world terms of wealth and of whatever influence I have where I am. I think we see this in this period after the exile. It was people that God had placed in positions, but they needed to make themselves available to him to seek his heart in the way that Nehemiah does. So I would challenge you, let your prayers be like Nehemiah, aware of the character and the promises of God and grounded in what is on God's heart and in God's purposes, but also confessing sin before God and then confidently asking God for the favour that we need to speak for him, to serve him, to do his will.